Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the show, we're going to be speaking with Paul Larmer, who is the publisher of High Country News and who's going to be in Santa Fe this weekend. Right now, we're going to be talking about the film Living with Wolves. Jim and Jamie Dutcher, filmmakers, join us by telephone. And Jim Ehrman of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance joins us right here in the cafe. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning. Let's start with Jim Ehrman. Jim Ehrman is actually with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance that is sponsoring the presentation of this film and a whole wolf evening at the Lenzik on this Friday night at 7 o'clock. What is the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance?
New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is a not-for-profit organization that concentrates on preserving wild lands and working with our congressional delegation to designate more wild lands as wilderness.
And so wild lands and wolves are certainly connected.
Very much so.
Let's turn to Jim and Jamie Dutcher. You've made a long film, I guess for the Discovery Channel, that is actually about not only you're living with wolves, but you're actually assembling a wolf pack from scratch. How did that come to pass?
Well, wolves are very elusive. They're extremely afraid of people. And to have their trust, we started with puppies, bottle feeding them from the moment they were born, about 10 days, 10 days old. And having this trust, we were able to release them into a large enclosure and be with them without scaring them, frightening them. And
if
that
I may
way,
ask, where did you their get, behavior. Where did you get wolf puppies? During the course of the film, these little wolf puppies show up periodically.
Well, we had... We worked with a woman in Montana who had seen Jim's earlier film on mountain lions, and she had done some wolf rescue and felt if there was any way she could possibly help, she wanted to be the one to do it. So she had, in the past, had rescued some wolves and from a naval project, and she allowed them to breed and have the pups. So we started with those pups, so they were born in captivity. But I want everyone to know that, you know, these were in no way pets. Everything was on their terms. We just created this bond so that the wolves would be comfortable with us, so that when we would film them, they wouldn't stop what they were doing. They wouldn't change their behavior, because we were really delving into the social life of these animals.
Now, it's interesting, because I wondered to what extent whatever you found out about them would be or has been considered valid data scientifically, because they didn't actually learn from their own parents. These are wolf pups that were, in fact, raised by humans, even though you did things on their terms.
Right, and that's a very good question. It's important to know that actually all behavior studies, all social behavior studies on wolves have been done in captivity, and usually in enclosures of 1 to 3 acres, which, you know, it's quite small compared to, we had, I think, the largest wolf enclosure in the world, which was 25 acres. Because the whole problem with observing wolves is that you can't get close enough to them in the wild to really, really, really watch their social behavior and figure out what's going on. So our study mirrored other studies by, you know, very well-known biologists and scientists who'd been doing similar work. Ours was just on a much greater scale.
So one of the goals of this project, at least as I understand it from watching the film, was to dispel myths about wolves. What are some of those myths?
Well, number one, wolves don't attack people. There's never been an attack on by a healthy wild wolf on a human being in North America. Wolves are afraid of people. And that wolves will eat up all the cattle and sheep if they're set free. It has turned out to be less than 1% of the livestock mortalities are attributed to wolves. and that wolves will kill all the elk that hunters are allowed to shoot. What's really happening is the elk are being redistributed. The fear of wolves has driven them out of riparian areas like in Yellowstone or in central Idaho, and now these areas are recovering. Trees now stabilize the banks of streams and create shade. This lowers the temperature, making the habitat better for trout. The carcasses of elk feed other scavengers, including grizzly bears and bald eagles. So, and wolves chase away or kill coyotes, which prey upon rodents, and these rodents are food for birds of prey. So it's helping trout, it's helping birds of prey, it's helping grizzly bears. So it's just an amazing success story.
It's interesting because the place in Idaho, in the Sawtooth Mountains, where the film takes place, where you lived for, 6 years, I guess it was.
That's right. In a tented camp.
In a tented, in a yurt, in a tent. I mean, I got cold just watching the film, but it was a place where I guess there had once been wolves, but there were not now. Is that correct?
Well, there used to be wolves in the Rockies and all the way down to New Mexico and Arizona. But back in the 20s and 30s, the wolves were killed off. They were poison shot. And the sad thing is now that the wolves have been recovered, we have quite a few of them in the northern Rockies, people want to shoot them again. There are about 1,500 wolves now, where when we started our project, there were about 15 wolves sort of sneaking around the Rockies. But now the recovery is very successful. But the state of Idaho wants to shoot 570 of their 670 wolves.
And I think what people are going to find out when they come to the event at the Lensic Theater is that these animals are so social and so incredibly intelligent that they're not going to be difficult to eliminate again. And they really need our support and understanding, and because they are so important to a healthy ecosystem.
Well, that point that you were making about the ecosystem, you didn't go into in depth in the film, but at the end, the wolf pack that you were instrumental in creating is released into Indian land and actually helped the ecosystem there.
Well, they were set free into a similar enclosure that we had, because these wolves had lost their fear of people, and if we had let them go just into the wild, they would have wandered onto some ranch and probably gotten themselves shot. But these wolves were ambassadors. This is how people learned about wolves. The project ended in 96, and about 95 and 96 is when the 60 wolves were released into central Idaho and Yellowstone. And so these improvements in the ecosystems have come over these last 12 years, and it's just amazing how fast this has happened. These are the courses and lessons we learn in school about biology and ecology, and you could just see it happen in Yellowstone in 10 or 12 years.
When you release the wolves have lost their fear of human beings because you raised them and became very friendly with them. Wolves don't live that long. They have a shorter life cycle even than dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And yes. When 2, 3, 4 generations down the line, do they regain their fear of human beings?
Well, what happened was when we transferred the wolves onto the Nez Perce tribal land, we had a big discussion with the tribe and what the goals were for these wolves, because they were going to have, we knew ahead of time that, you know, these wolves were going to have to live the rest of their lives in captivity and be ambassadors. And it was decided, since they were going to be in an enclosed situation, rather than to allow them to keep breeding, because then there's no place for them to expand, we did tubal ligations on the females so that they would keep their normal breeding patterns, but they wouldn't produce any pups. And the hope was that by the end of this project, by the end of the lives of these wolves, we wouldn't have a need for captive packs anymore, that there would be a better understanding for wolves and how important they are to an ecosystem. And we're finding that a tough job. So, you know, we've been just going around the country talking to people, trying to get them to understand wolves a little bit better, that we all can live together.
One of the interesting things was the structure of the wolf pack, with the alpha and the beta and the omega. I mean, it was funny because I just had been watching The Godfather 2 on TV the other night, and it was like the mafia. I mean,
or kindergarten.
Yeah.
There's always a wolf on the bottom, just like there's a kindergartner on the bottom that everybody picks on, and that's the omega. And what was interesting in our pack, we had the alpha and we had a beta wolf, which is the second in command. Well, the beta wolf always protected the omega, and it was quite dear to see this.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When you watch wolves, you really watch the way people work. I mean, wolves aren't related to us, you know, like chimpanzees, of course, but their social behavior is so similar. And we were... We had done a presentation at a university, and the head of the sociology department had come up, and he said, "I just have to let you know, I use your films to teach human behavior in my classes."
Yeah, well, you don't want to analogize too much, but it's pretty clear. You kind of can't avoid it either.
Yeah, you really can't, and you just sit back and watch, and you're like, oh, my gosh, I know someone like that, you know.
Well, in our project, in the very first year, we had a female omega wolf that had it used to go off by itself just to, so it wouldn't be picked upon, and a mountain lion killed this wolf, and this wolf always excited the pack into play. Omegas do that a lot, just to diffuse pack tension. And after the wolf was died, the rest of the pack lost the spirit to play. Their howling changed. They used to gather together to howl with a lot of excitement and yips and whines. And after this one omega wolf died, the wolves would howl separately and very mournfully. Now, this is something that we've heard about from other biologists, and recently in a little town near us where a wolf was shot, the town of Stanley, Idaho, heard the pack howling all night long for weeks and weeks. So, and we've seen up in Alaska where wolves have suffered the break of a jawbone. We've seen skulls, and yet the wolf must have recovered. The bone was healed, and this means that the other pack members must have brought food to this wolf. This wolf hadn't been able to even pull flesh from a carcass, much less kill for itself. And yet this wolf lived on for years and years, and we've seen these sort of breaks in many different places, in Yellowstone and other natural history museums.
And yet, the feeding hierarchy is very much how you understand the pack hierarchy. In other words, the omega does not get to eat before, or even at the same time as the higher up wolves in the structure of the pack.
That's right. The omega has to wait, and you know he's the low man on the totem pole, and it's the alpha who dictates who eats first and last. And everybody gets onto the carcass before the omega does, and you know he'll still try. But he'll get disciplined for it, and that's just his lot in life.
And sometimes they actually change roles. One wolf that looked like she was going to be an omega ended up essentially marrying and having kids with the alpha.
Yeah.
You cannot predict, you know, wolf behavior. We had this one female pup. And we would watch her, and we would look at her and go, oh, my gosh, she's going to be an omega. And, you know, she'll be an omega female. You know, we had Lakota, the omega male. And that's just the way it was going to be. She was shy. She was always picked on by her siblings. You know, even the other wolves, adult wolves picked on her. And we thought, well, she's doomed, but, you know, that's going to be her lot. And then all of a sudden, she and another wolf, her sibling came into estrus at just about the exact same time, and it was like a light bulb went on in her head, like, it's now or never. And she suddenly became very aggressive and just really blossomed. She's like, I'm going to be the alpha.
We're talking to Jim and Jamie Dutcher. Their film is called Living with Wolves, and you're going to be presenting the film, a clip, a part of the film, or the whole thing at the Lensic on Friday night at 7 o'clock?
Right, we're going to be doing, it's going to be a multimedia presentation. We have we're going to be doing a bit of a lecture and a keynote slide presentation, and then we're going to be showing a shorter cut-down version of our film, which will be, we've taken portions out of it and edited it back together because it would just be too long of an event. So this will give people a really good idea of a wolf pack and wolf behavior and what it was like living with wolves. So we hope it to be a very interesting and fun evening for everyone.
Now, the film was funded, I guess, by the Discovery Channel. Is that correct? Has it been
shown
on that channel?
Yes, it has shown. It first broadcast on Discovery in 2005, and they repeat it quite often on Discovery and Animal Planet, I think.
Have you been able to tell whether there has been any influence? I mean, obviously part of this is an attempt to have a political influence and stop the shooting and killing of wolves.
I have to say we have seen a direct impact in it changing and changing attitudes and getting people to think a little bit more about the wolf. We've received numerous letters from hunters, for instance, who would write us and tell us, you know, that they hunt in the woods of Wisconsin and that they hear wolves. There are wolves up there. They do hear wolves and find tracks of them, and they were afraid, very afraid of what was going to happen. And they caught our film on television and realized what this animal was all about, and they're now no longer afraid. They know that the wolf in the woods is not out to get them. And we had another presentation where we were doing a ranching community, and we were warned it could be quite a chilly reception, and everyone filed in. It was a sold-out crowd, and there was one rancher in particular who came in, and he was pretty upset that his wife was dragging him to this event, and the woman putting it on was watching him, and she said, you know, gosh, by the end of the evening, I there were tears in his eyes, and he got up after the event, and he goes, now I get it, now I understand. So it's just, you know, we're trying to change people's attitudes one at a time, and to also get people to realize that these wolves, the ones in the Rockies, the New Mexico wolves, they belong to all of us. You know, these are federal wolves, and they are on federal land, and we all have a voice in what happens to them. It's not just a statewide issue.
The photography is amazing in this film, and also the sound recording of the wolves' howls, which really served kind of as a musical soundtrack, would you say?
Yes, Jamie actually won an Emmy for her sound recordings, and in the vocalizations, it's just not howls, but you know, the yips and whines that wolves have. It's quite a conversation that they go through.
And there was a sense of their communication, Jamie, that you had, that probably extends far beyond what we are able to understand, that they are actually communicating with one another.
Oh, absolutely. You know, spending that long a period of time with headphones, you know, just recording them and listening to them, you know, I was able to figure out, even if I couldn't see who was howling or communicating, who was doing the talking. And there really seemed to be a definite language there. They weren't doing it just to do it. They really were communicating in ways beyond, you know, the ways we could even imagine.
Is that being studied by anybody?
Some people are studying it. It's you know, they're running vocalizations through machines, trying to check inflections and just see what's going on out there. But it's still probably in the pretty early stages.
One of the things that amazed me about this film was you were actually able to, after the female wolf had puppies, crawl down into their den with a camera and take pictures of the puppies. That seems like potentially dangerous work there.
it was a little worrisome if my rear end was going to end up intact when I came
exactly.
out. But, you know, we had, you know, as you know, we had raised Shamook, the alpha female, from the time she was a pup. And when she denned, we thought, well, you know, we're going to have to go in and see what's going on in there. And, you know, it was decided pretty early on that I would be the one to go in because we had a pretty close relationship. And I just, you know, I sat with her outside the den kind of just trying to build my confidence. And I just kind of thought it's now or never, and she seemed to give me the signal that it was okay, and I crawled down there, and it was pretty deep and pretty tight, and thinking, well, you know, if I do get bit, it'll be my rear end, and I'll be all right. But I checked on the pups, and I crawled back out, and she was right there outside the den waiting for me, gave me a lick on the nose, and went back in. So it was an amazing experience. It was something I'll really never forget.
Yeah, she really had the trust of this wolf.
They're so close genetically to dogs. Was it difficult to keep from treating them as you would a dog?
Well, we had names for them, but they didn't know their names. We just labeled them such so we could tell one from the other. But everything was on their terms. We never approached the wolves. They would always come to us, and we would kneel down, and they would come quite close to us and lick our faces and say hello, and then that was over. And one time we had another cameraman with us that wanted to film this sequence, and he got a few shots, and he said, well, let's do that again. I said, well, that doesn't work that way. It's like going to a dinner party and shaking hands to the host and then going back to the front door and doing it again. You know, the greeting was over. We'd have to wait a day or so.
Yeah, and, you know, they're so big and they're so strong that, you know, even though you're looking at them and you're thinking about your dog, you really can't play with them. You can't try to engage them in play because, you know, they've got a lot of fur and pretty heavy coats, and if you were to try to do something like that, you know, they might gnaw, you know, kind of, you know, give you a, like your dog might do a gentle kind of gnawing on you. They could do the same thing, but they could also inflict a lot of damage doing it. So we didn't really want to encourage it. We really wanted to be furniture for them. We didn't want to impose ourselves on their lives. It was as little as possible, so we wouldn't change the way that they behaved.
The time is 8:30 here on KSFR. Is there anything you want to let our listeners know, Jim and Jamie Detcher, before we go?
Well, we'd love to have everybody come out to the Lensic Theater and see the event because, you know, you've got the Mexican wolves there, and I think this will give people a better understanding of what the wolf is all about. The Mexican wolf is a gray wolf. It's a subspecies. We just want people to have a better understanding of this animal.
Well, Jim and Jamie Detcher are filmmakers whose latest film is called, I don't know if it's the latest film, but a recent film is called Living with Wolves, and part of it will be presented along with a larger presentation at the Lensic this Friday, November 9th at 7 in the evening, sponsored by the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. And David Ehrman has been sitting here very quietly with the Wilderness Alliance, but I want to thank you for being here as well.
You're welcome, Mary Sherilyn, and Jim and Jamie look forward to seeing you later this week.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to the event.
Great.
Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.
And thanks to Jim and Jamie Detcher. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Paul Larmer of High Country News. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome now, joining us by telephone, Paul Larmer. He is the publisher and executive director of High Country News, and he will be in Santa Fe this Friday at 7 o'clock at the Forum on the College of Santa Fe campus, and it's part of the College of Santa Fe's Beyond the Lecture series, Bridging the Cultural Divide. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Let's talk about High Country News. What is this institution, and how did it get founded?
Yeah, sure. It's we're founded in 1970 up in Wyoming, in Lander, Wyoming, by a rancher named Tom Bell. And so we have a long history here in the West. Tom Bell was basically a guy who'd come back from World War II, had seen a lot of the development, especially the energy development that was happening in the Northern Plains, plans for giant strip mines, lots of uranium mining, lots of other things. And he felt like the West needed a voice, an environmental publication that would be a voice for people who were concerned about the environment. And so he started that in 1970. It over the years has become much more of a journalistic enterprise, and in 1983 it moved to Paonia, Colorado, and had a new publisher and editor, Ed and Betsy Marston, for the next 20 years. And So we've covered the entire West. We cover 11 states, 1 million square miles. We focus on, a lot on natural resource issues, but we also cover a lot of cultural issues in the region. And, you know, right now we have a staff of about 20 people who work out of mostly out of Paonia, Colorado, a small kind of mining and ranching town here in western Colorado.
What are some of the issues specific to the West, to western ecosystems and western land?
Well, we've been covering almost everything you can imagine. We cover fire ecology, for instance. What happens after a fire burns? How do you get it to regrow? What is the mix between exotic species and native species? And what are some of the perils of fire?
Let's talk about that for a moment. Fire.
Sure.
I mean, wildfire is a feature of forest just as much as trees are a feature of forests. They happen by themselves. What is the human role in fires in our great forests?
Well, when the Santa Ana winds blow, I think humans do have an impact. They get that impulse, that itchy impulse to light a match and see what happens. But certainly fire is a natural part of the ecosystem in the West. Almost, you know, everything from our sagebrush to our higher elevation forests, even aspen forests here in Colorado burn once every 100 years or so. What's interesting is just that the fires continue to get bigger over the years, especially in the last decade or so, where we used to have several million acres burn a year. Now we're kind of getting 7-8 million acres in the West burning every year. And a lot of people are attributing that to some climate change, drier conditions, less snowpack in the winter, and also a lot of the problems with people building homes in the urban wildland urban interface, building in places where fire is going to happen, and expecting kind of everybody to come to their rescue.
What is the impact of climate change, not just predicted, but actual real climate change that you and your writers see in the West?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we had a writer named Michelle Nyehouse do a whole series of stories over the last couple of years. And she went to places like Yosemite National Park in California, where she hung out with these scientists who were taking a look at these surveys that a scientist had done 100 years ago about where mammals and squirrels and small animals were found. This guy took incredible notes 100 years ago about where exactly he found these animals. These guys went back and tried to retrace exactly where he was and did surveys of the same areas, and they found that a lot of the animals weren't there, or that they were about 1,000 feet up in elevation. They had moved up the slopes. So there's some real evidence that animals move when climate changes. And, you know, we're also, of course, to focus on the water issue. There was a big piece in the New York Times Magazine this last week. Well, that's a subject that we've been covering for years, especially looking at the Colorado River, which is so central to the interior West. I know you guys are more on the Rio Grande there, and there's certainly a lot of water issues with the Rio Grande. But the Colorado in particular feeds Southern California, feeds Las Vegas, and yet all these states upstream also have huge growth happening. And, you know, how can we have all this growth and still have enough water supply, especially if places like Lake Powell, which is the big reservoir, are only at half capacity at this point? And so, and most hydrologists are predicting that the reservoir may never get up again in the next couple of decades to full capacity. So we're dealing with a smaller pool of water than we ever imagined.
You have these real questions about water, and High Country News does a wonderful job describing them. Do you also have people suggesting policies that would actually help deal with this, what you call, shrinking pool of water?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, the states themselves are struggling with this and negotiating and trying to figure out ways that they can share a smaller pool of water. But we do try to get think pieces into the magazine. We have it's funny you mention that, because I'm talking with a writer right now who's a water policy expert who would like to propose a new way of allocating water on the Colorado River that would make more sense. And so, you know, we will float ideas out there and try to see what kind of reaction is out there. We kind of consider High Country News a marketplace of ideas. And we're a nonprofit, so we have a little bit of advertising, but it's kind of the socially and environmentally responsible kind, and we really rely on readers for our income, subscribers. And that I think that gives us a level of freedom to kind of explore these issues no holds barred.
We're talking to Paul Larmer of High Country News, and he will be here in Santa Fe this Friday, November 9th at 7 o'clock at the Forum in the College of Santa Fe. Another thing that you mentioned a moment ago, which I thought is important to talk about, is exotic species. What do you mean by exotic species?
Well, in the West here, if you look along any river corridor, you will see plants and trees that you might assume are native, but likely a lot of them will not be native to the North America even. For instance, there is the tamarisk plant, which I don't. You probably have a lot of it on the Pecos River and other places.
We have them in abundance here, yes.
Right. And, you know, that is a plant that was introduced about 100 years ago. It's now spread to almost every river basin in the West, and it sucks up a lot of water. It's not incredibly very good habitat because our native species never evolved with it, birds and plant and other animals. It also tends to shut out other species from growing. But it's also a symptom of kind of our river systems, which have become depleted of water as we've diverted more and more water. And so it's a species that does better almost than our cottonwoods and our willows in those kind of circumstances. So we've done stories on tamarisk, for instance, over the years, and we have an upcoming story about the effort to release these beetles. So the species came from Asia and Kazakhstan and areas over there. And so scientists have now gone over to Kazakhstan and found the beetles over there that actually eat tamarisk and have now released them in several river drainages in the West and are watching them eat through the tamarisk here in North America.
Is that actually working?
It's working. It's amazing. It is working. Whether it'll totally work, it probably will not totally work. I mean, it's not going to wipe out tamarisks forever here in the West, but they will at some point establish some sort of equilibrium. But
I mean, there's stories about predators being brought in to eat things from that you know people want to get rid of, pests of some kind. For example, the cane toads of Queensland, Australia, that came from Hawaii, and they've taken over Queensland. I mean, it's dangerous to be introducing predatory, even if they're just bugs, is it not?
It can be, but the truth of the matter is it's happening. You know, we are mixing species as never before on this globe, and a lot, you know, with our transportation systems. We recently did a story about Lake Mead down by Las Vegas where they found these little mussels called quagga mussels related to the zebra mussels of that another exotic species that basically has taken over the Great Lakes and it's clogging up water pipes there. They can reproduce immensely fast. They change the ecosystem of the water. They clear it of a lot of stuff because they filter all this water, these little mussels do. But on the other hand, that allows a lot of sunlight to the bottom of the lakes, and it causes a lot of algae blooms. So we're changing things all the time, and now some boater apparently had some attached to the bottom of his boat in the Great Lakes and drove out to Lake Mead and put his boat in, and bang, suddenly they're in Lake Mead now, and it looks like they're going to spread all over the place. So we're in this great global era of species mixing, and I think the West is right in the middle of it.
Let's go back to water for a second. Not only is river water a problem when so much of it is drained off for development and growth, but there's also the use of groundwater, which is essentially being mined and not replenished.
Correct. We did a big story over on Prescott, Arizona, and other places where there are proposals to, you know, further take out groundwater and use that as a supply. But what we're discovering is that those subsurface waters are often connected to the surface waters. And so it looks like you have a new supply of water, but in effect you're lowering the nearby river. And, you know, it's on the Front Range here in Colorado, we have that problem as well. A lot of home buyers have bought homes in these subdivisions where supposedly they have a 100-year guaranteed water right, but they water supply. But in fact, they're finding that the aquifer beneath that they're relying on is dropping really, really fast. And so, you know, we have to live within limits here. And the truth in the West here is that, you know, water always moves toward money. They say it'll move uphill toward money. And what we're finding, we have a big story, for instance, coming up on Los Angeles and the big metropolitan water district there, which is the biggest water district in the country, and they are negotiating with farmers to get water now from farmers and leasing water from farmers. Farmers will let their fields go fallow for a season or two, and it's a whole new era of negotiation because agriculture continues to use about 80% of the water in the West. So that's the huge reservoir, really, that's out there, in addition to conservation and other things.
Let's talk about the issue of logging. What have you seen in terms of logging in the West, and how do the political issues around logging line up?
Well, of course, you know, during the mid-late 90s, we covered a lot about the old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest and the spotted owl country and Bill Clinton's attempt to broker a deal up there, and the fact that logging really has declined greatly in places like that, and those small towns are having to try to reinvent themselves, and we've done stories about that. Interestingly, in the Southwest, we've done stories north of Santa Fe there about some of the collaborative efforts between some Hispanic loggers, some of the environmental groups even, to do small-scale thinning projects on the forest that not only kind of provide some fiber and some money for the economy, but also help improve the ecology of the forest. So we're really interested in where interesting bedfellows get together and figure out ways to do things new in the West. It's not the old, we're going to clear cut, you know, several thousand acres at a time like we did in the old days. It's going to have to be a much more considered kind of logging, and it's starting to take place, and even in the Ponderosa Pine Country near you guys.
Now, High Country News was founded by a rancher. There, I think the media sort of like to polarize people, you know, loggers against environmentalists, environmentalists against ranchers, and so on. But you're really seeing a different picture.
Yeah, I mean, you still have that polarization in the West. And a lot of my talk on Friday is going to talk about the polarization that I've seen here locally where I live, and also just around the region, and especially around the ranching issue. But you're also seeing a lot of saner minds out there getting together and saying, you know, there's got to be a new way to do it. And what I think has really fomented a lot of this is the notion that we have this kind of growth happening in the West, and people moving in, and a lot of development happening. And if we want any open space, I think it's going to have to be a collaboration between conservationists and ranchers. If we're going to want the public lands to not be totally overrun with oil and gas wells, or with wells that will be eventually, areas that will be cleaned out and replanted and returned to the native environment, then it's going to take some collaboration. And, you know, unfortunately, the national politics can help set either the tone for that or a poor tone for that. I would say that the Bush administration's push to open so much of the public lands to leasing for oil and gas, to the oil and gas industry, has actually polarized things more than necessary. On the other hand, sometimes you need a real huge push like that to bring people to the table. You need, you know, a dire situation before people actually say, hey, you know what, let's get together and figure out a new way to do it. And I think, you know, that's happened in the ranching community, where you see conservationists working with ranchers to figure out conservation easements on property to keep it open so that it'll never be developed, while still giving the ranchers some money in their pocket to keep going. You're seeing those kinds of activities taking place, small-scale logging efforts, collaborative work on restoring rivers, even in cities and places like that. I think, you know, there's a lot of good, positive news out there, too. Although people do call us High Country Blues, because we tend to focus on a lot of those issues that are so tough and seemingly hard to resolve.
Well, not only do you have the issue of presidential executive directives, but you also have, as there's an article on the current issue, about anti-environmental judges packing the courts. How has this been affecting Western ecosystems?
Well, we did a series on the courts a few years back, and those articles continue to be really popular on our website. It's kind of counterintuitive, because sometimes there are judges that were appointed during the Reagan administration that have actually been fairly positive on the environment, and some, of course, under the Clinton administration, maybe that weren't so positive. But what we have seen is when there's long-term one party in power, that the judges tend to start, you know, they get to appoint more judges. And over time, that has an impact on everything from, you know, on these same issues we're talking about, grazing, logging, mining, in the enforcement of the laws that we already have on the book, the Endangered Species Act. There's going to be more conservative rulings on those things where there'll be less government intervention. If the BLM, for instance, is not protecting wildlife, it'll be harder to get a judge in certain places to rule in your favor as a conservationist. That packing of the courts is just a fact of life. We did do an interesting – that piece is interesting because it takes a look at individual judges around the West and kind of what they've ruled on and when they were – you know, what their background is. So it's kind of a little-known part of the West and a very influential one.
We're talking to Paul Larmer of High Country News, and once again, he'll be here this Friday at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe at 7 in the evening. Issue of immigration is also one that you cover. What is the relationship between immigration patterns and the land of the West?
Well, we've all heard a lot of these stories by now. The immigrants coming across the border in Arizona and the impact on the desert down there, the impact on ranchers. We've done some interesting recent stories. We did one on the Tohono O'odham Nation, which is a giant Indian reservation in southern Arizona on the border, and tribal members are very used to going across the border, both because those are their traditional lands in Mexico and in the United States. And just in the last 10 years, that has really become more of a war zone, with the Border Patrol beefing up its presence, with more drug smuggling taking place in those areas. And so you have this tribe, which has a vast land resource, but only a very small number of tribal members in the thousands, single thousands, I think, even, trying to cope with all these tremendous changes that are taking place down there. And now they're dealing with the fact that the federal government wants and the state want to build a fence along most of their reservation, kind of cutting them off from their traditional land south of the border. So we look for stories like that. We also did a story about jaguars in the Southwest recently, jaguars, you think of them as a South American and a Central American species, and indeed they are, but they also traditionally had habitat in Arizona, New Mexico, you know, even potentially up to southern Colorado. And recently they started finding more of these big cats coming across the border, and they've been monitoring them. And conservationists are really hopeful to get a population established back in the United States. But at the same time, we are now building this fence, which, if it's going to keep people out, it's probably going to keep cats out too. Although cats are pretty good climbers, but still.
Right.
So there are real ecological concerns about when you try to put up a border fence. But we also cover immigration as it impacts communities. We did a big piece on, many years ago, we broke ground in Vail, Colorado, you know, big ski resort country where, you know, we were one of the first to report about who really is working all these jobs in the hotels and the restaurants and cleaning the toilets and things like that in these resorts. And a lot of them are recent immigrants, and some are even brought in specifically to do those jobs. And, you know, it has tremendous impact because the cost of living is so high in those places that the workers really can't live there. They end up living 50, 100 miles away, packed into trailers, parks, and yet they're kind of an invisible part of the economic landscape. Although I would say now the numbers are growing so much of Hispanic people moving into mountain communities that they really are fundamentally changing these communities, you know, and putting new stresses on them for sure in areas like education, schooling, but also, you know, providing a tremendous economic boom in terms of construction workers, landscape, and all the other service industries that really make those places go. So this disparity of wealth is something that we cover a lot in the magazine as well.
We're talking to Paul Larmer. Do you see also a positive cultural impact of the Latin migration in some of these communities?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think there some of the towns, there's a little town over the mountains from us called Carbondale, and used to be a former mining town. Then it became kind of a suburb of Aspen, and now it's really a vibrant community of a mixture of Anglo and Hispanic peoples, and there's lots of new restaurants going in. There's you go to the grocery store, there's totally new food selections in lots of the store. There's a whole new kind of cultural vibrancy there. I don't know how it's going to play out over time, but to me, those towns are more interesting and exciting than they've ever been before.
One of the things that we're looking at here in Santa Fe is the prospect of oil and gas drilling in the Galisteo area, which is right next to Santa Fe. People are extremely concerned about a lot of issues, including water, land values, and the potential destruction of the land. When you see oil and gas coming into a watershed, into a undeveloped area, being there for 15, 20, 30 years, then leaving, how do they leave the land? What is the worst-case scenario, and what is the best-case scenario if they do their job properly?
You know, that's a great question, and I think it's one that journalists really haven't delved into too much, and I hope nobody else gets the story before we do it. But oil and gas restoration is really a huge issue. Unfortunately, we don't have lots and lots of examples of old gas fields. There are some, I think, in other parts of New Mexico down south, and maybe to the east even, I think, that have been our older fields. And, you know, most of the people I talk to say those areas are disaster areas. They're just a network of roads, a web of roads, old pads that were never reclaimed. It's a changed landscape forever, basically. And with the kind of precipitation we get here, it's so little. Things grow so slowly that you really need a huge effort to restore those areas. And the problem is that the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, requires so little from the companies in terms of bonds for restoration. And it may seem like a lot. I think it's like $10,000 is kind of the basic starting fee for a couple of wells or something like that. I'm not absolutely sure on those statistics, but it's fairly small. And nobody's really seen what's happening. Wyoming is booming right now. Colorado, western Colorado, is booming right now. So you can go to these places and look at them, and you can see that there's always new roads being built, but we really have no experience yet with kind of taking those roads out, you know, at the end of the process. And I think as long as gas prices are high here, it's going to be quite a while. It may be 20 years from down the road from now that we actually are at a place where, okay, now we really have to restore it. And the question is, will there be any money there left at the end? And who's going to do it? Have the companies left or not? I mean, we experienced the mining law in the late 1800s where you go up the high country in Colorado and in New Mexico and you'll see old mines and lots of leaching out of natural toxic elements because they've been mined, and it's poisoned some of our rivers. But the companies are long gone, and finding the money to actually restore these areas is a tremendous lot of work. And you would think that we would have learned from the lessons of the timber boom and the mining boom and others, but it seems like we like to repeat history here in the West. So the oil and gas boom seems like we're going to still have some real hard times trying to restore the land back to the way it was.
And right now, the rules really don't exist to make that mandatory.
There are some restoration requirements that the BLM puts on it. From the BLM people I've talked to, there's kind of fairly spotty enforcement, not only during the development process, but afterwards as well, as far as full restoration. If you only have a few inspectors for an entire, you know, northern New Mexico or whatever, and I'm not sure how many are there exactly, but that's kind of what the scenario we have here in western Colorado is very few inspectors or people who would go out and try to enforce those regulations.
Well, and, Paul Larmer, unfortunately, it's time to go. It's been wonderful talking to you, and we look forward to seeing you on Friday, November 9th at 7 o'clock at the Forum on the College of Santa Fe campus. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Take care.
Paul Larmer is the publisher and executive director of High Country News, which is a publication that you can find on the web at hcn.org. And once again, he'll be here this Friday at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe. And it's part of the College of Santa Fe's Beyond the Lecture series, Bridging the Cultural Divide, put together by the marvelous Carol Carpenter. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's my website. You can listen to the show there anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Ciao.